This is Phantom Electric Ghost, and we're live on the air with Kirsten Rudberg for the first time. You're an author, podcaster, screenwriter, clergy producer, and I do want to thank you for joining the Phantom Electric Ghost podcast. How are you doing tonight?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing fine. As everybody can see, we've got your link up there, bitesizedblessings.com. That will be fully clickable, so you don't have to worry about trying to type that.
Yeah.
Everywhere that we're published right now, we're on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitch. Once those are fully published, they're live right now. You'll be able to click through on that. In addition, you can see that listen on Newsly. We are a featured podcast on that platform. So folks who want to try that out for free for 30 days, they type in Ghost. They can listen to Newsly where we're a featured podcast. We'll be on there later tonight. And I do want to talk about today, we're going to talk about listening to the universe as kind of a focal point. And then we've got your link up there. And we'll let people know we're at episode 1048 with this episode, tracking that on Apple Podcasts since 2016. So thanks to all the folks who listen to us and watch us. But again, listening to the universe, that's kind of the topic. But before we get to that, one of the things I like to ask people is what motivates you and why do you do what you do?
Oh, gosh. Oh, my goodness. Okay. Well, I have to say, as far as just being in the world and, you know, the reason I went to seminary, I really, really desire to kind of help other people, help people make this world a better place, connect people. When I lived in Santa Fe, New Mexico, one of my jobs was as event coordinator at a coffee shop down there, a really large coffee shop with multiple locations. And my job was amazing. I got to bring in authors, bring in screenwriters, bring in poets, bring in musicians, and just design the entire night, advertise, get the word out, and support them. Get people to see them, engage with them, they would not otherwise have exposure to, but really give them a platform to shine. That's one of my biggest motivators, is to help other people get heard or seen or witnessed or whatever you want to call it. I just love lifting other people up and getting them exposure. So yeah, yes.
That's interesting, kind of like what podcasters, what we try to do. When we talk to the guests, like we're talking to you, it's like we try to take people who are maybe, you know, they kind of like emerging talents, emerging voices, yeah, and give them a venue to speak what they're good at, what they know.
Yes.
And that's kind of what motivates me too. So it's the same kind of vibe. One of the other things we're going to ask you about is a question you like to answer, is like, who am I as a human being? Which is something, which is like a lot of people probably don't think about asking themselves that, but you know, that's an interesting thing. I noticed that question. So I said, well, I'm going to ask that.
The shoe is on the other foot. I was telling, you know, when I interview people for my podcast, I tell them, you know, I thought the question about, have you witnessed anything miraculous, was the challenging one, but no, so many have said this question, who are you as a human being, really stumps them. And a lot of them really try to unpack it. Like, what does that mean with other people or my interior life or who in the world or my job or whatever. And I just thought, gosh, I thought that was like the easy question. Cause in seminary, you know, every new class, you had to have a 3-minute bite about who you were. So I got good answering this question. My answer is I'm a third culture kid. I grew up in Guyana, South America, and in Lahore, Pakistan. And so my entire life has been informed by exposure as a child to a culture or cultures other than my own. And it has had such an incredible just effect on me, and it is shapes every way I am in the world. I think it makes me more open to conversations with strangers or entertaining different ideas, or maybe even just respecting and being open to having, you know, conversation with people I disagree with. I would say that I'm an open person. I believe in generosity of spirit, even though I fail continuously at that, but I do try to practice. and just see the best in everyone, which is naive. I realize this. It's very naive, but still. And some days I'm grumpier than others and it's harder to do, but I think I try to see the best in everyone. Like, I believe in people. And so that's a central kind of tenet of my life.
That's really interesting to have that kind of worldview, because a lot of times today people are like in like one camp or the other. Everything's like black and white, yes. You know, yin and the yang. It's like, there's not a lot of crossing over. I'm a child of the 70s. And in a child of the 70s, it's like, there was a lot more kind of like cross genre, cross idea. Like, there's, you know, the Beatles got into, you know, the things they got into, which weren't necessarily Western philosophies. They got into these Eastern philosophies.
Yeah.
You know, George Harrison was getting into, you know, playing like a lot of Indian based philosophical concepts. The whole band was being driven by Eastern, you know, mysticism. Yeah. And that was more acceptable, where you have people now today will say, well, I can't even do that because I got to stay in my paradigm. I can't think outside this box. And then they make judgments if anybody's outside that box. So it's like, I try to live more expansive, which means that you have a mindset where, like, you know, if somebody's a Buddhist, if somebody's a Hindu, somebody's an atheist, somebody, whatever. It's like, I'm not going to go and say, well, I can't talk to them.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, but if you put up walls like that from the start, like, where's the world going to go?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's interesting, you know, they have a different religion in Guyana and South America than they do in Pakistan, you know? And I think coming back to the States was really horrifying for me, because I went to a school with kids from all over the world, of like every color, religion. We were all in that school. So I grew up playing with every kid under the sun. And then my parents moved me back just outside Chicago. And all of a sudden I was like in middle America, everyone was white. And the concept at that time, because I'm a kid of the 70s too. Well, we came back to the States in the 80s. I'd never understood that what you brought in your lunch at that time, like Velveeta cheese slices, like what you brought in your lunch was a status symbol. Jordache jeans was like a status symbol. Izod shirts. I mean, it was such a weird world for me. And the transition was really depressing. And it horrified me. And because of that, I got, I had to repeat fourth grade because the social, it was super challenging. Just the shock and the horror.
Cultural shock, like reverse cultural. I can give a little story. My daughter grew up in Japan. I lived in Japan and she went to a Japanese preschool and a Japanese kindergarten.
Cool.
So when we got home, she was like in first grade and she had never been in an American school. She had been in a Japanese school that was an international school. So she met people from all over the world. And so her school was super diverse in Japan. By the time we got back to the U.S., came back to Connecticut, and she was in this like suburb, and it was like nobody looked like her. There's hardly anybody from any other culture. And she had like the reverse kind of cultural shock, because she was used to like hearing Japanese. She's used to, you know, hearing English, both at the same time, other languages too. And it was all just one way. And she was like, why is it like that? You know, it's hard for her. It's like it took extra tutoring to kind of get through, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I, you know, it wasn't until I started seminary that I realized, oh my gosh, I think, you know, coming back to the States and being shoved into middle America and just, you know, I kind of sometimes laughingly call it Stepford. Like my life became Stepford, the Stepford Wives, but I was a kid. Just being thrown back into that world was the first time I felt like my heart was broken as a kid, because I knew none of the social constructs. I knew none of the culture. I knew nothing. And the kids made fun of me. It did not help that my mother sent us to school in clothes that we wore in Pakistan. That did not help. But it was, the kids were ruthless. And I just thought to myself, this is the worst.
Well, the bullying kind of thing that people think is acceptable. And I remember being a child in the 70s and some kid told his dad at the bus stop he was going to beat me up. And the dad said, go on ahead and do it. So it's like, so when you have a parent that says, yeah, that's a good idea. It's like, well, okay, you're already like going down the wrong road. So like if you, the problem is like people say, oh, these people, they've got these good like intentions. Like I was living in a neighborhood where there are a lot of bad intentions, right? There, so, you know, and so people weren't as like all American, you know, apple pie, like they say, right? There was other things going on. And there was a lot of bullying. There was a lot of intolerance. Mm-hmm. And people don't want to talk about it. But the fact is like, okay, like if you're not in the other category, you might not experience it. So you say it's okay. But if you're in a different group, if you happen to be the kid who's a little bit like oddball, they're all, you know, wearing different clothes, having a different experience, you can get put into that other category really quick. And you'd be surprised. And then you're like, wow, this is a different experience than what I expected.
Yeah. And kids can be just as bloodthirsty as adults. It's so weird how, to me, because again, I said one of my main things is I love meeting different people. I love entertaining. The world is so polarized now. The United States is so polarized now, but I really work on having this belief that everyone, no matter what their, you know, worldview or their political slant or what have you, really there's shape for people to be friends. And in that way, in that kind of being friends or sharing a meal or whatever that looks like, maybe you get to know about someone else and maybe you hate them a little less. And that's kind of, I mean, my childhood, it's just, you know, having that experience and coming back here, I think really changed me forever for wanting people to get along and maybe give other people a chance, you know, kids a chance.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I have that kind of open door. And you know, there's a certain level of vulnerability that you have to have, because if you have, like the first experience that you get with somebody and they're immediately not nice, well, it's hard to be kind of like kumbaya when somebody's not nice. Right? If somebody's being a bully, it's hard to kind of, oh, bully's going to come over for breakfast. It's like, yeah, if he's going to put me on the floor, I don't know if I want him over for breakfast. But like the idea is like, okay, turn the other cheek, try to have breakfast with the bully. But you know, it's just like the mindset is like, try to win over by trying to do stuff, you know, like you get into sports, like when you're boys club is like, oh, you prove you can do the football. You prove you can do the basketball, you prove it. Then suddenly they start to like you. Right. So, and sometimes you have to win them over. Sometimes you have to sacrifice, you have to work harder. But you have to be willing to do that like harder thing rather than like saying, ah, forget it. Right.
I mean, there were lots of times when I was a kid where I got knocked down. And I mean, like I said, it did nothing for my popularity that I had to do fourth grade again, because, you know, everybody was what's the rumor that I'm not smart, that I can't hack it, that I am a loser, you know, and that took multiple years for people to forget about. But it was necessary, because when we were in Pakistan, I was first day on campus at the school, and my dad was walking me to class and he said, so do you want to be in kindergarten or first grade? In kindergarten, I had no idea what that meant. And it sounded scary. And it was a word. And then first grade sounded like winning, hashtag winning, because you're number one. So I said, let's go to first grade. So I was too young for everybody. Like,
you jumped right into it. Oh, yes. Wow. It wasn't explained to you like what the, like maybe you need the preschool, kindergarten, yes, kind of start, yes, there. Can you jump ahead? You kind of skip in a grade, but yeah, you know, we don't know where kids, we go with what sounds good. The first sounds good.
Yes.
But I think like living overseas, that really changes your mindset, right? It's like, it's a mindset. Yes. It's kind of this multicultural, multi-language kind of situation where, you know, I think it's really important if you're in Europe or if you're in Asia, it's very common that people know multiple languages. You know, when I was in Japan, I ran into Europeans, they knew Spanish, they knew German, they knew English, they, you know, and some of them knew Japanese or they knew Chinese. But America is like a badge of honor, like not to know other languages.
I don't understand that. I mean, there's just such this, a little bit of a self-absorbed, self-aggrandizing attitude in America where, you know, I've worked in lots of restaurants and cafes, and there are a lot of Latin American people working there, a lot of Mexican people there, a lot. They invariably know two or three languages. And, you know, the idea out in the world, or this thing that's being floated in society, that immigrants are idiots, they're stupid, they have nothing to give us, they have nothing to contribute. I'm like, these people speak two or three languages. How on earth do you think that you're smarter than them? Because they can go many places in the world and be fine. You can go, you won't be able to speak to anyone, and you're going to starve to death potentially because you don't know how to ask for food. And I just don't really ascribe to the idea that you can, first of all, pigeonhole or label millions and millions of people in that way. But also, I think knowing another language is so beautiful. It's such a beautiful thing because it shows respect for the culture that you're learning. And by the way, English is harder to learn than Spanish. And so for every immigrant that speaks English, they've already done some sort of Olympian task that we as native English speakers can't even imagine at all. And so we get the easy end of the bargain. French, Spanish, not as hard as English. So,
yeah, it's just what I found when you learn other languages, you learn like a different mindset. Like if you think about the Eastern mindset, like Japanese, Chinese, other languages from the East, you know, the fact that they use like symbols, like hiragana, katakana, it's kind of like Middle Eastern languages. They have a more symbolic, they're kind of older. They're older forms of language that have symbols that actually are like pictures that represented ideas. Like in Japanese, the kawa, it looks like a river. It's a kanji and it looks like a river. And some of the kanjis for trees and stuff, they look like trees because it goes back to like original, kind of really old humanity. It was like, okay, we're going to make this language actually represent the world. And so when you get into language like that and you see these symbols, they have these really deep meanings that are beyond like the 25 letters of the alphabet. And so it gives you a different world perspective. And it, you know, it's kind of ignorant not to understand how deep that can be. And how much you're actually probably missing by not understanding those things.
Well, and the idea of that is so beautiful. You know, it's so gorgeous to just think that you, and I think also of Mayan hieroglyphs and just, you know, how much meaning they could pack into one little glyph, depending on what they added or they took away or how they wrote it. And I just, it inspires me that humanity has such a capacity for creating new things, for communication, for just getting ideas across in all sorts of gorgeous ways. Makes me get up in the morning.
It's like very artful. I mean, when you look at some of the hieroglyphs, it's like art. Yeah. It, like my daughter was learning how to do hiragana, katakana, and kanjis. Mm-hmm. And she ended up becoming a graphic artist because as a preschooler, kindergartner, the first thing she was taught was these Japanese and Chinese kanjis and katakana, hiragana. And, you know, the Japanese share a bunch of kanjis with the Chinese, like 2,000 characters are shared between both languages. And when you start, you know, it just gave her this visual artist perspective that she still has like a Shinto culture, Asian like affectation to her work, that allows her to do certain brushstrokes that are very Eastern style, right? Compared to a Western style artist. And it was a gift. You know, we looked at that, like our experience there, the knowledge transfer was like, you know, it was coming a lot from the East, and it gave her a perspective. It gave me in business a different mindset, like the Japanese business mindset of like zero defect and kind of the honor of like the Bushido code. And there's a lot of different cultural aspects of things that you can learn from other cultures that can aid and give you a lot of insight for your life. So to just immediately push down other cultures as being like inferior is not a very I don't know, enlightened way. That we talk about the enlightenment, well, you need to kind of get re-enlightened.
Right. No, no, absolutely. And, you know, I was really lucky because as a kid, I mean, I traveled everywhere because of my parents and my father's job, which was building massive hydroelectric engineering dam projects for developing countries. And, you know, so I was went to the Maldives when I was a child, Bangkok, Bangladesh, which is not on everyone's tourist vacation spot, Kashmir. And so as a kid, you get to see how gorgeous this world is and how different and varied and how nature is different everywhere and just how breathtaking it is. And by the way, what different churches and temples and houses of worship look like. And you run into strangers who are always the most kind, wonderful, loving human beings. And so when you come from a world like that, where everything's just so generous and gorgeous and accepting, and you come back to the States where everything's kind of locked down and you have to wear Jordache jeans and otherwise you're made fun of, it kind of like rocked my world. So I'm a huge fan of learning other languages. Your daughter can do that work because she has been able to incorporate with her consciousness multiple ways of being in the world. And she assimilates it all into one cohesive story while she's working. And I mean, growing up overseas is like the biggest gift you can give your kids, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. We felt it was like, you know, we were looking for a way when we were in the States to get my daughter into a really good preschool. And then we got this opportunity to go to Japan. It was like a bigger advantage than we even thought, because we were just going to put her into some private preschool in the States before we went. And then we're like, wow, the fact that we were able to go to these Japanese schools, it was just like, it is an exponentially bigger benefit than what we had thought we were going to do.
Yeah.
And it's just interesting, like when you start to look at like creativity and, you know, just the connection to the world, like, you know, if you just didn't like looking at Mount Fuji or going to an onsen in like in a parts like of Japan that have like the mountains and in the colder weather and looking at the snow monkeys and stuff. There was this amazing things I could end up go to Kyoto and see everybody wearing the kimonos and just like the temples. It's like, and then the tech and the kind of cross thing. There was all this ancient stuff and then really super modern stuff.
Yes.
In the same spaces. Yeah. And we're like, that was so, how they thread the ancient with the modern was just incredible.
Yeah.
And I just was like, just like blown away every time I was in Tokyo or any part of Japan.
Yeah.
And it was like a universal experience. It was like, I felt like I'm getting in tune with this like muse or something. And it was just felt like there was a lot of energy. Oh. I just felt the energy of such a big city like Tokyo, and just to be in that city, it was a blessing to me to be there, and how I was treated like a guest. That like very wasn't like people throwing stuff at me, yelling at me, telling me go back home.
And
it's like Americans should like kind of look at the tree like you maybe assume if you go somewhere somebody's gonna do that, but that, you know, my Japanese friends that come to the U.S. is like, they didn't get treated the way I was treated in Japan.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That's such a shame. One of the things that's always affected me is, you know, in Lahore, we lived in a gated compound and didn't really mix, but we would go travel places and do things and, you know, go to the Taj Mahal or whatever, go out on the streets, not very often, but one of the things that was the most powerful thing for me was going out on the streets. The level of suffering and poverty that I saw was as a kid was so breathtaking and made me really aware at a young age of how privileged I was, like beyond privileged, that I didn't have to worry about food. I didn't have to. And we're talking about kids with like insane deformities and missing limbs and every single person, no matter what situation they were in, were so kind and welcoming. And, you know, they didn't begrudge the fact that I was privileged. They just were there and kind and generous and welcoming. And I just think about your experience as well, right? I mean, it sounds like you had that incredible experience over there that was so similar. But then, yes, you come back here and it's a very different story.
So, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I live in New Hampshire, totally, you know, a totally different type of society, a lot less diverse. And, you know, I live well here, but it's just like, it's not the same as what I was doing in Tokyo at all. Like, it's not even the same as New York or Boston. You know, it's like just the kind of openness and the willingness, you know, just to be able to, I had friends from Australia and Germany and, you know, China, and, you know, you could go to Hong Kong on the weekend and come back. You could go to, you know, you just had this kind of international perspective.
Yeah.
That I don't know if a lot of like Americans can even get themselves in that frame. You know, if you just think like Oklahoma is the best place in the world and you're never going to go anywhere else, that's fine. You can believe that, but like mm-hmm. you're missing a lot. Just to not understand the world. And the world is so, because of the net, you know, I get to talk to people through this from all over the world. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like I was in Japan and kind of why I do it. Yeah. Because I kind of miss that cosmopolitan nature of Tokyo. So I try to, you know, replace it with the way to connect with people that gives me the same connection in a virtual world.
Yeah.
But I find it necessary. I wonder if you, like, you do what you do to try to connect with a lot of people. Is that because you were overseas? You feel the need to try to, you know, connect as much as you can?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think part of the reason I do the podcast, which has had every kind of human you could ever imagine. I mean, you'd think it's called Bite Size Blessings. I basically ask people if they've ever witnessed or experienced something that was magical or miraculous. You'd think it'd be a religious show, but it's not. I've interviewed atheists. I've interviewed agnostics. I've interviewed religious people. I've interviewed people who are like, I don't know what I am. But, you know, part of it was I went to seminary at a very liberal school in Denver, Colorado. And a lot of my cohort were LGBTQ+ clergy. And just trying, and there were also, you know, I'm a panentheist, so I don't have a prescribed religion, but there were Mormons in seminary. It's like truly evangelicals. They all came to this school. It was very inclusive. And I just saw and witnessed, I mean, besides of what I saw as a kid, seeing the struggle of just being LGBTQ+ and trying to be a clergy person and what that looks like in the world. And I just thought, here's another thing that I haven't experienced. And these people are experiencing it. I respect them. I like them. And I just thought, you know what? I just really want people to get to know each other. Like, because I really feel deeply that that is one way that we can introduce each other to each other in a safe space. So that's what the podcast is about. It's about bringing in guests, bringing in people listeners might not otherwise meet in their everyday life, hearing their stories, getting to know them and thinking, oh my gosh, they're not that different from me. They're not that odd. They're not strange. They're not the devil or whatever. And I had a review that was sent to me that said, you know, even though I don't agree with your guests, you really get to the heart of who a person is and you show their humanity. And I was like, that's it. That's what I'm doing.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. They were able to get somebody to actually appreciate and not just immediately shut you down.
Yeah.
Because there's such a tendency today to people to want to be like in the box.
Yeah.
They have like truths that they believe that, well, they have beliefs that they think are truths and they kind of been taught kind of top down. And what I've always been into is like the kind of idea of like Socratic thinking or kind of, you know, holistic thinking, which means like you challenge your biases. You challenge what, you know, kind of like a scientist keeps on testing something until they break the theory. Because like something is like, they're not going to be totally tied to it if they're shown evidence there's other things. And so I've always been kind of a very kind of, you know, it's like, if you think about it, it's like the whole era of the liberalism, but like the intellectualism of like the Victorian age, you know, when you had the Shakespeare and the Victorian poets and you have all these people who are pushing like boundaries. They're going to like the bleeding edge of things and kind of challenging art, talent, you know, showing the human figure, doing more. And certain people might say, oh, you can't do that. You can't do, but people were just showing that kind of like, I don't know. Is this idea that you can have both sides of your brain operating in the same space? You don't have to be one or the other. You can be like a combination of every inner and outer mysticism and science, art, religion. Why not?
Absolutely. I love reading history. And so one of the historical, this has happened a couple times, you know, since Christianity and Islam and Judaism appeared on the scene. But there was a period during around the year 1000 that there was a time of relative peace. And in Europe, Christianity, of course, was prevalent, but the Moors and Islam came in as well. And then there was a big Jewish enclave in Spain. And it was peaceful. People got to be their scientific selves, whatever that looked like at that time. And by God, if they didn't have like a period of fecundity and like discovery and revelation about the world, scientific discovery, just conversation, because nobody was trying to kill each other. They weren't all hating on each other. And I was just like, oh my gosh, this is what happens when people get along. Like, this is what happens when people get over themselves and like work with other people. We have these leaps and bounds in like knowledge and creativity and art. And so I just really want that to happen again.
Yeah, it just seems like there's a balance of power that gets tied to sometimes major religions. And then people try to control from the top down for their own kind of power drive. Because like, if you get certain people like, well, they don't want some of this thinking to happen because it's about actually controlling not just hearts, minds and body, but property, you know, resources. And so if you get to say that this group of people on this resource are bad people because they are in the wrong religion, then you can justify taking it away, which has always been kind of like the human behavior. Like, if I need this water, I need iron ore, or I need this, then I'm going to take it and I'm going to justify the reason to take it because these people are not good people. And then I can tie that to something. And it's always like, you know, it's kind of Machiavellian. He's like, there's a reason why you're going to war. You got to hate somebody. Well, how do you hate somebody? It's easy to go and just tag them as, oh, they're a bad person because they don't believe what I believe.
Yeah.
And it takes a little bit of like critical thinking. They say like, why should I do that? Should I just blindly do what the top dog tells me to do? Or should I say like, why would I do that? Sometimes it seems simple, but sometimes it's not so simple to sit down and think it out.
Yeah.
Because the kind of world has a pressure to make you not want to sit down and think it out.
Oh, for sure. Oh my gosh. I mean, I sometimes joke. I mean, TV, media, TikTok now, not Facebook. I love all these platforms used judiciously, but I do think these kind of time sucks, these things that kind of have us all kind of addicted, they're soporifics to like help us shut down. It helps shut down our critical thinking. So we're endlessly going back to being entertained. We're endlessly chasing that high of something new or hilarious or seeing the latest video. And it distracts from us being like critical, grounded, intelligent thinkers in the world, because that takes work, you know? It takes work to actually figure things out for yourself. And I love sci-fi and fantasy and love all that stuff, I also think to myself, you know, you can't stop, don't get addicted, because you have to be in this world. You have a, you know, a bone to pick with some things, and
we should try to be present, you know. Yes. And I think it's just being present and diving into reading and reading comprehension is kind of core to me. Because I mean, I went to a liberal arts school, I went to Bowdoin College, and it's like the Socratic method wasn't just taking like a multiple choice test. It's like a blue book. And you got to tell the professor in your own words what the concepts were without saying it's A, B, C, D. No, you have to write it out. You have to think it out. You have to make an oral argument in front of the professor sometimes. And I think we've lost that because people just want to go do SAT kind of multiple choice. Did you really learn it, or did you memorize things? Are you able to actually take something and put it in your own words and take that theory and put it into practice with your own examples? And I think a lot of times we've lost the capacity to take the time to read text, to read, you know, mysticism, to actually understand, read epic poems and not get bored, but actually try to learn the lessons from history. You know, read something that's a little deep, something that's going to take a little bit from you. It's going to take some time, whether it's spiritual or mystical or whatever. Just take the time to kind of understand the lessons, understand what it's trying to say. The fables is like there's a lot of beauty in it. And if you can understand it and not just be dictated to understand it, but kind of understand it from your own time you put in, not just somebody told you what it means, but you actually go and kind of derive what it means.
I'll tell you a funny story. So after repeating fourth grade, I go into junior high, seventh and eighth grade. I'm still super shy, so scared of everybody. So I end up being in the library 24/7 when I'm at school. So before school, I go to the library. Recess, lunch, I go to the library. After school, I'm at the library. And they had all these tests where you could get points for reading books and answering questions and stuff. And I think it was like end of my seventh grade year, the guidance counselor came and took me aside and said, "Oh, we have a meeting with your parents." And I thought, what's happening here? And she brought me to my parents in this room. And she said, "Your daughter is not developing socially at all. She's hiding in the library. She's banned from the library now. So she is forced to make friends." And I was like, "What? I mean, I love the library. I love the library. What are you talking about?" And I was, I couldn't go to the library anymore. And that first day, it was horrible. I walked out into the gym where they were having recess, and I thought I was going to throw up everywhere. I was so terrified and so scared because I didn't have any friends. And these three girls were sitting, they were also kind of quote unquote outcasts, and they took me in. And, you know, when I always tell everybody that when I graduated from eighth grade, they voted me class bookworm, merited. And then because of what the guidance counselor did, when I graduated from high school, I was nominated class clown. So,
oh, wow.
So you got more social. I learned to talk to other people.
Yeah. I was in the nerd group. I was in the Star Trek club. 1974. So, you know, so we're in the Trekkies and we're in a Marvel and DC comics. And I was with all the kids. Like, I had a Polish friend, a Jewish friend, and we were all like, people were coming down on us. So we're like, I was a black kid, a Polish kid, and a Jewish kid. And we found ourselves as a kind of group. And we, you know, with power in numbers. And then we started doing things that people like, we're going to the comic convention. All you jocks, do you know what that is? And it's like, and then some of people would say, "Oh, maybe that's cool. Maybe we should go try that out." So then people would start hanging out with us, go to the Trek convention, go to comic. So we started getting like a larger group of people. And then video games came along, and we were already on that. And then people was like, "Oh, you guys got Atari? Yeah, we got Atari. We're the nerds. We got it." So so then we started getting some popularity. But it's like, you know, you start to build up from where you can.
Favorite Star Trek series?
I like the classic, you know, one with Spock, because Spock to me, he represented like the other. I really could identify with Spock as a kid. Every time I saw Spock, the McCoy coming down on him, talking about, "You green-blooded alien." Like, wow, I saw something very familiar. And I liked how he would respond. And he was always like, he always blew everybody away. He was stronger than everybody, but he was controlled. He was way stronger than anybody on the ship. And then he's smarter than everybody on the ship. Mm-hmm. And he would like take his time. And it's like, "Yeah, I got the answer. You might not believe it, but I got it." Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm smart and I'm more powerful than you. I'm more smart, but I'm actually going to be kind of sedate and not overplay my hand.
Yeah.
But like, he always could get it done. And I thought that was a cool way to be. And I was like, yeah, I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. My favorite is Next Gen with Jean-Luc, just because I was in college when that came out and it was just so effing delicious and good. I just love it. But the playful childlike part of me will always love The Trouble with Tribbles. It's like my favorite because I wanted that to happen to me. I wanted to open my closet one day and just have these sweet little.
Have all those tribbles bounced around.
Yes. Yes. I love.
It was such cool science fiction show.
Yes.
Yeah. It was science fiction, but it was like morality. It's like typical of most science fiction. Roddenberry and Rod Serling through science fiction would have these morality tales. Yeah. And so they would say, well, Cole, it's on this other planet, but they were actually making comments about society.
Yes.
And I would always love the way that they could sneak it in. And that's why I was like, well, that's really cool. They got Outer Limits, Rod Serling, Gene Roddenberry. They would sneak these morality tales in the science fiction. And then I said, oh, I got to read of Harlan Ellison and Ben Bova and all these Ray Bradbury. And I kind of got pulled into that because I like the fact that they can make comments, even though they're in this futuristic world, they're actually making comments about this world.
Mm-hmm. Do you still read sci-fi?
I read a lot of sci-fi stuff that I'm into. But I mean, lately I've been like diving. I do a lot of music production. Okay. So I've been reading a lot of biographies of like people like all the great musicians going into like I'm into the jazz era, so I'm reading about Davis and Coltrane, so I'm kind of in that mindset now, but so I've been reading a lot of like nonfiction, but you know, biographies of like great artists and trying to understand their motivation.
Okay, well, if you are up for sci-fi, best trilogy I've read maybe in my entire life, have you heard of Shishun Liu? He wrote The Three Body Problem. That's the first title in the trilogy. Mm. It is so unbelievable. I mean, it's rare for me to find a sci-fi book or even a series that just rocked my world. Unbelievable.
Well, I have to check that out. That's cool. I like to take recommendations.
Yeah. That's my recommendation.
When I was in high school and junior high and college, I was into like a lot of that, but I kind of moved into other things now. But yeah, I think it's just amazing like what you were able to learn from the seminary and from your international experience. And one thing I would like to, I always try to ask is like, what are like some key lessons from living abroad, like a core lessons that you could kind of relay to the audience?
Gosh, I mean, number one would be, I know nothing. I know nothing. And I mean, and that's so true. I don't know anything. I mean, I do know some things, of course, but when you go to another country or you're faced with someone who's really different or a culture that's really different or a religion that's very different, I mean, I had to just accept I really do know nothing. I mean, this world is full of things that I know nothing about. And just having humility around being in other people's spaces and places is a big thing for me. I would have to say that is the biggest. But also, you know, the big thing is like this world is an enchanted and wondrous place. And there's a beauty everywhere, like everywhere. And whether it's someone's art or it's the way someone's house looks or, you know, a song that you hear, or if you go to another country, like the way they build their houses or how they use local materials, like there's so much gorgeousness in this world. That's the other thing. So I'd say those two things. Yeah.
I remember like food for me was like, wow. Like I really got into seafood in a way that, you know, that's totally different than like, if you don't live in a place like a Japan or Hong Kong,
right.
There's an appreciation for that type of food. But yeah, I mean, you get a different, you know, it's not just hamburgers and hot dogs and steak, T-bone steaks. Yeah. It's like some other stuff.
I'll always have like, Indian food. That does it for me. but that's because of my childhood. So yeah.
So that's just something that stuck with you.
Yeah,
you still got the taste for that.
Yeah.
And maybe this is another question we've been asking is like, what are three things that folks should know about you that maybe they wouldn't expect?
Oh gosh. Well, you know, I'm an author. I'm rewriting the Peter Rabbit book series, which it's, I love Beatrix Potter. She's super subversive. A lot of people don't understand that, but mm-hmm. With today, what's going on with the environment and intolerance and like in general sweatshops, human trafficking, you know, I just wanted to rewrite the stories with a little bit of a science fiction slant, which it's a 13 book series. As it progresses, you'll understand that it has a little bit more of a sci-fi bent. The first three have been published. I'm actually really lucky. George R. R. Martin's bookstore in Santa Fe is carrying the series. They really like it a lot. But it more forcefully engages with environmental degradation, with, you know, just bulldozing whole forests and rainforests, human trafficking, sweatshops, as I said. So I'm just making it more overt. I'm also a screenwriter. So I have, I'm a writer, you know, I have a really fun series on YouTube called Murder of Two, which is about two crows sitting on a line observing humanity. Every single episode's about 2 minutes or so long because I really like the short, tight form. I love writing. And I think, you know, being in the library as a kid for all that time helped me. I learned how to write, which was a huge thing. But the other thing is I hate being up in front of people and speaking. It makes me physically nauseous. So in seminary for my internship, one of my growth curves was learning to get comfortable in people, because the idea is that you're supposed to like give sermons and stuff. And I did one for the UU church in Santa Fe, and I could, like, I was having arrhythmia the entire time. I couldn't wait. And at the end, so many people came up to me and they said, "Oh my gosh, great sermon. But next time, please slow down," because I was just so fast. I was
you might be able to get out of there.
yes. And then COVID hit in the middle of my internship. And so I didn't have to do it anymore. And I was like, I'm going to pretend like I'm not super excited about this.
But do you find doing like the public speaking through the podcast or through the way we're doing it right here that you don't get that anxiety when you do it this way?
I don't, it's so much easier and I don't know why. Oh,
that's interesting. Because you can actually reach a lot of people through these types of platforms, but it doesn't have the feedback that some people I've run into, like musicians, hate this kind of format because they live on the crowd. Because they like to do performances and get the immediate feedback of the room.
Okay.
And this type of thing doesn't give you that immediate feedback of the 1,000 people in the seats.
Yeah.
But I get that. To a person who's more sensitive to that.
Yeah.
You could do without that. And you feel better when you don't have that. But there's certain types of people that kind of need that. They kind of live off of that. And it's always found it interesting, the kind of dichotomy is like, there are people that can do, they can thrive on these kind of platforms because they find like, wow, I'm not getting that feeling like I did when I went to a student assembly or I tried to give this speech. And now I'm like, I'm trying to run away from day, you know, second one on the mic. I'm like trying to get off the stage.
I'm like, run away. I forget. What is that? A Monty Python, one of his movies where he's like, run away. That's me. I'll be running away. It's so much easier. Hiding behind, I don't think I'm hiding, but it's like hiding behind the camera, hiding behind wherever I'm recording. It's just a total difference than getting up in front of, I don't know, 100 people and having to give a sermon. Ugh.
You have so much control now. Now you can have these live things where you could be interacting with people on a seminar or a webinar. Yeah. It can be live. And it just gives a lot of opportunity to have these voices heard, to have your voice heard.
Yeah.
And I think it's really cool that you're able to kind of, you know, actualize and be who you want to be without having that frame. Because we can have these other frames.
Yeah.
And that's just like the openness of the tech that allows us to be here.
Yes. I love it.
So I guess one question, another question that's interesting is like how to maintain hope in a world that's fractured. And we see it. If you watch news, you can get totally disenchanted and you can get real upset and you might not see a lot of answers, but to have a different, that, you know, to have a mindset where you're not getting overwhelmed by the bad news.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things I do, I just call it like tending to my heart, because I have a really deep feeling heart that is sensitive to a lot of things. And I realized a long time ago that play, like I still want to be a kid and have fun and play. It's like so essential for me. Thus being with friends or watching an incredible movie that I loved and watching it again, but also online, like Instagram, there are just incredible artists out there that I discover practically daily who do the sweetest, most gorgeous, incredible art. And that kind of reminder every day that there are people out there innovating and doing incredible things and bringing beauty to the world helps me so much. I need to do that. It's like every day dipping my toe into the well of beauty that humans are bringing to the world. That helps me. Reading a good book helps me. Finding new authors who are doing incredible things with the written word, that helps me. And it's kind of, I mean, I'd have to say beauty, meeting someone who's an incredible human being and is enchanting in their own right, that helps me. It reminds me every day that there's gorgeousness in this world and that maybe I should not read the news because it's kind of negative a lot of the time.
They kind of make money off of pushing like the most, you know, extreme examples of humanity is kind of like their filter. And once you realize, like, you know, like you said, if you get up in the morning and you're happy just to hear the birds, you look out and say, wow, this is a beautiful New Hampshire sunrise, right? This is a really, you know, walk in the pines and the Merrimack River. I'm like, wow, that's worth walking, you know, being here, you know, just to walk mount, you know, go on a hiking trail and just be in the world.
Yeah.
It's a blessing to be able to get up and do that.
Yeah.
And that's free. That doesn't cost any money. And then the other thing, like you're saying, when you see these emerging artists who throw their work into the world, and like, you know, that vulnerability is what I always, as a producer, I'm not so much into people cloning what already exists. Yeah. I've always tried to push people to show me what, like, you're scared to show with people.
Yeah.
Because I want to see who you are. And, you know, show me you can sing a Taylor Swift song doesn't show me who you are. Shows me you can do that, but she already does it. I'd rather hear you do something that's you. And so that's harder for people to do. And some people think that, oh, they need to do whatever's popular. But it's like, if you can show up as your unique self with your vulnerabilities and your kind of just, you know, everything that makes you you, that to me is like, that's the real humanity.
Yeah.
Why I like art, because it's like, I don't know what to expect. And I'm kind of looking for something, you know, that I never seen before.
Yeah.
And that's or heard before. That
is
not the remake of a movie I've seen 10 times. It's like, I'd rather not do that.
You're like, you're just a huge fan of sequels, aren't you? You know,
love not them. So much. Like, where's the original thought? Like, I don't need to see another Hitchcock film because Hitchcock already did them.
Yeah.
You know, show me something new. Show me something, a different perspective. So there's so many people just, you know, I understand that we live in a world where like tried and true is easier than never been done.
Yeah.
And you know, you probably get funded for tried and true more than never been done. But it to me is more exciting to see than never been done.
Yeah. I mean, I think it helps all of us understand that so many people see the world in ways that we can't even encompass with our own minds. And it's exciting to know that the world can be seen in so many different ways and that there's so much potential in so many human beings to just observe things and then channel them into whether it's a song or a piece of pottery or a painting, just how they interpret the world or how they experience it. I think that's what's exciting about this place. So,
Yeah, and like when you live overseas, you can just see it.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
Oh, for sure.
You know, you're just walking on a street and you see the artisans on the street,
yeah.
You know, the street vendors with all this unique stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like not like we live in like kind of Walmart world, Target world, but you go to other countries, like you go out to the street market and see all this like pottery, all these handmade things.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, that was so cool
yeah.
to walk in different parts of, you know, Asia to see yeah. that creativity.
Mm-hmm.
And we can see it, you know, if you go to your local downtown and see the farmer's market, there might be somebody doing something like that to support the kind of local people, the kind of Main Street, which has been going away because there's certain people don't like that. They want to turn everything into the corporate world, but yeah, it's we kind of the Etsy model rather than the other model, like the handmade model is the online version, which is cool. But yeah, it's like there's a way to still do that in the modern world.
Absolutely. I'm a fan. I'm right there with you.
That's
I'm
cool.
there.
So your podcast, being a podcaster, like how long have you done your podcast?
Oh gosh, like a little over 3 years. I mean, I tell everybody, because so many people ask me, hey, how can I start my own podcast? And, you know, I did not expect to be at like episode 153. I had no idea what I was doing. None. So much so that like the first episode took me about 24 hours to produce. Now it takes me like 4 or 5 for each week. But honestly, it is, it's, and then I just think to myself, they don't really know how much work it is. Like I know that they don't know how much work it is.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work. I literally had no concept of what I was doing. I don't even know why I had the audacity to think that I could do a podcast, except that I just wanted to hear these people's stories, because everybody would, I mean, my whole life, people come up to me and they're like, I got to tell you about the weirdest thing. This weird thing happened to me and I have like no one else to talk about it with. And so that's kind of the genesis was I loved the show Spooked, which is an offshoot of, it's on NPR, I do believe. And it's mm-hmm. basically people call in and talk about their ghost stories. And I thought, you know, what's weird is like, everybody always talks to me about this other weird stuff that happens. I bet there's an audience for this. And I went to, I got, have a master's of divinity. I went to seminary. So I have the street cred. And thus the podcast was born. And the essence of the podcast is to hopefully introduce people to each other, as I said, but to just remind people the world is a magical place. There are good things and good people happening out there. And yes, it might suck, or the news cycle might say things are terrible, but there's always someone who's saying things aren't. And that's hopefully they're going to tell their story on my podcast. So yeah.
Well, I think it's great to have these forums to kind of dive into things that you think are important. And everybody has their own perspective on the voices they think people should hear. And,
yes.
You know, that's all what podcasting to me is. You know, I started it, you know, somebody found me, you know, mm-hmm. a couple of years, you know, back in 2016. And it was just a way to talk about music.
Yeah.
Me and this guy named Rock Tunes, we just started talking about music because we like music.
Okay.
And then we expanded it to talking to other artists. And then we went and said, well, you know, poets or artists, you know, photographers are artists, filmmakers are artists. Well, let's talk to everybody in that frame. And then we said, well, you know, all human beings are creative, so we can talk to therapists
yes.
and coaches and philosophers. And we just thread the needle and say, you know, all humans are creative. So why don't we kind of have this expansive idea of talking to emerging creative people that should be listened to.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of our open forum that started with artists. And then branched out the feeling that everybody has that creative spark. So I think, yeah, I mean, the podcasting is a great way to communicate, especially for people who might have had trouble. Like you were talking about, like you yeah. did not feel good about giving that public speech. And then you find yourself in a public forum able to make an impact. It's just beautiful the way this forum has become. I think I really look forward to the future of this format, because I think it's very powerful.
It allows
people to do powerful things.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, I love science fiction podcasts too. And so, you know, there's nothing I love more than just the egalitarian nature of it doesn't cost a lot to put your show up on something and have it available all over the world, you know, depending on what platform you use. It makes storytelling or just getting your idea out there, talking to other people, very accessible. And that's what I appreciate about it. It's a generous space for lots of people. So, yeah.
Yeah. And you're able to do these long form in a world that is so short form.
Yes.
You know, In a world that's got attention span 30 seconds, 90 seconds, 2 minutes, you're able to do something that has a wider frame. You know, get some big podcasters, they go 3 hours, so you can go anywhere on this perspective. You know, we do an hour, but, you know, some people do 15 minutes, 30 minutes, but it's a longer form than what we see in social media typically. Oh, and yeah. I think it just gives you the ability to dive into something. Mm-hmm. Like we did tonight. And I want to let people know again that bitesideblessing.com, that'll be fully clickable and people connect with you there. Maybe before we leave, you can say, if somebody clicks on that, what do they find there?
You'll find a list of my episodes, a list of my guests. You'll find the other projects that I'm working on. I have a treasures page where, you know, books, media, music, art that I think people might be interested in that makes them happy or where they'll learn something. And just a little bit about me. Yeah, pretty simple.
Cool. Well, I want to thank you for being a guest on the Family Electric Ghost podcast. It always comes by, it goes through, and we get through it faster than I ever expect. But I do thank you and appreciate that you took the time to be on the show. And we will get this out to the wider audience. We're on all the major platforms that podcasts can be listened to or watched, and that will be available to your audience by tomorrow. We were live on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitch. And thank you very much for being on the show.
You're the best. Thank you so much.